What is going on, everybody, and welcome back to the Starting Small Music Podcast. I'm your host, Justin McCormick, and today we have a very special guest joining the show. We have country artist and songwriter, LV Shane. You're going to hear LV's story of growing up in Kentucky and what first got him into music. You'll also hear the story behind writing his hit song, My Boy, stories from touring on the road with Toby Keith, and finally, LV is going to tell us about his brand new album, Damascus, that drops on April 19th. I had a great time talking to LV, and I hope you guys enjoy the episode.
Just keep a smile on your face and it'll be okay. Try not to be bitter, you gotta do it either way. Keep a smile on your face and it'll be okay. So when life throws a jab, you gotta duck out of the way.
How you doing today, LV?
I'm doing great, baby. How are you doing?
I'm doing awesome, man. So getting right into your story, you grew up in Caneyville, Kentucky. What was your childhood like down there?
Oh, man. I was just thinking about this the other day. I was thinking back to that awesome time in life. Upper decky.
Oh, I'll put one in too, brother.
I think about that awesome time in life when we didn't have cell phones and how, you know, I lived in a little basement house halfway down the holler. In Caneyville, Kentucky, off of Post Housie Road. Lived there my whole life. And when I was bored, I would just, like, go walking in the woods.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I would trespass on a daily basis, you know, just walk wherever I wanted to. Everybody around knew my folks, though, and knew me. And most of the time, I would just, like, when I was really young, I would grab a BB gun and just go out in the woods with my dog, you know, or later on a 22 or a shotgun or something like that. And there's this really like almost magical place across the holler from where I grew up called Pine Arbor. It seems magical when you grow up there. The song we just put out, Does Heaven Have a Creek, Does Heaven Have a Creek Where I Can Swim in My Old Blue Jeans. And there's this little swimming hole down at Pine Arbor Creek where me and my brother and his friends used to go when I was real small, and we'd just jump in our blue jeans and go for a swim and then go for a hike and spend all day out there. It was an awesome place to grow up.
So when you were growing up, what kind of music was getting played around the house that you feel was like your first introduction to music that kind of made you feel a connection to it?
Oh, man, my mom absolutely hates listening to music in the house, so no music in the house. But mom would listen to 90s country in the car exclusively. There was this station over from Owensboro, Kentucky, that she listened to a lot. And then my dad was more of like classic rock and Southern rock mixed with like, he also liked Heartland rock a lot. Well, I call it Heartland rock. Like to me, Steve Earle is like the epitome of Heartland rock, but also a little bit of country. Yeah. Steve Earle was definitely my dad's favorite, along with John Fogerty, you know, so mom was real big in church. Dad was not. They are polar opposites, still together 45 years. But I would go to church on Sundays with my mom and I would sing hymns. And that's kind of where my first love for music came, was singing those hymns at church. And then I would get home, you know, and there'd be a skunky smell floating around the holler and beer cans laying around and Southern rock on the radio. And that was Dad. And he was usually under the hood of some old car or truck or working on a semi truck. I spent a lot of time out in that driveway with him learning 4-letter words and how to turn a wrench. And mama gave me Jesus, daddy gave me Jones, you know?
Of course. Yeah, man. Now, what age did you pick up the guitar? Was that in high school or was that even later in life?
I was, I was 12, I believe. My sister got me a job hauling hay for a friend of hers that she worked with, I believe, and I saved up some money from hauling hay, and I bought a Fender flat top guitar off of my Aunt Marcia for like $150.
Oh yeah.
And then we didn't have YouTube then, and we couldn't really afford guitar lessons. My mom tried to put me in guitar lessons later on after I'd already like taught myself so much stuff. I think the instructor told my mom, hey, he's already taught himself so much, he doesn't need lessons. But what he really meant was, I can't put up with this little asshole. So I need you to take him back. Because I was a pretty high-strung kid, which is why my aunts would never teach me how to play piano either. I can play a little bit, but not real good. But yeah, so I started playing guitar when I was like 12. I'm still learning. I'm not that good. I've got my one thing I do, and it gets me through,
No, I always say I just know enough guitar to be able to write the songs. I'll let the people that are better at guitar fill in the rest of the parts, you know?
Yeah, I tend to like to have a good guitar player around,
Of course.
especially writing. The writing process has changed a little bit, but we'll get into that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, did you start writing songs like when you first picked up the guitar? When did that kind of come about for you?
I started writing songs, man, when I was walking around those fields and in the woods when I was just a kid. I would try to string words together. My two favorite records, like I was saying a while ago, is Steve Earle's Guitar Town record and John Fogerty's solo record from like the from I think it was like 1997. It was called Blue Moon Swamp. So I would hear those, the way that they put stories together really like painted the picture of like what I seen life to be, I felt like. And so I would try to string words together, and I got into, I think I was a sophomore in high school, and mama wouldn't usually let me like go to a different denomination church because grew up pretty strict missionary Baptist, and that's where we went and that's what was right and whatever. So but one night for some reason we all went to this other we went to a General Baptist revival, and while we were at the revival I was singing as I usually would. That was what I loved to do at church, and my buddy or this guy comes up to me, wasn't my buddy yet, but he comes up to me after service. He was like, "Hey, we've got a band and our sorry, this ain't my computer. I don't know if you heard that ding or not, but he was like, "Hey, we got a band and our singer just quit us. We got a show in like a week. We need a singer. Would you be interested?" I was like, "Sure." So I asked my mom. I knew she would say no, but she ended up saying yeah. And so I got into this band, and that was like my first kind of stepping into the role of like actually being a songwriter. And I thought we had some pretty cool stuff looking back. It was like his dad was the preacher, and we loved rock and roll, but all of our parents were pretty strict. And so we kind of like had a, it was like a emo rock band, but it like there was like good messages in the song and songs and stuff. So we kind of slid it past our parents by like sneaking in some religious reference every now and
I feel like a lot of
then.
that like early like punk music kind of has those kind of undertones though too. It's kind of weird.
Dude, like Blindside, I don't know if you know them. They're from Sweden, but that was a Christian rock group. They were amazing. Like Pitiful, so pitiful. That song was sick. And then what was POD? They were a huge Christian rock
Like
band.
Skillet even.
Yeah, that's so, yeah. It definitely sneaks in there, and that became kind of a. I mean, just kind of realizing it now. That was kind of the foundation for even my writing today. I still try to make sure and put some of that reference in a lot of these songs. This last song that we just put out is pretty much a hymn, but more of a good old boys hymn, if you will.
So you end up going to college and dropping out to do music. Is there any specific event that happens that like leads you to like feel called to do that? What was that kind of whole process like?
I don't know if I would say dropped out as much as they were like, dude, you just can't come back here no more. So I did really well my first year. So right out of high school, I went to Tennessee to work for the pastor of our church, and I was an evangelist preacher for like 2 years, and I just kind of traveled around Tennessee and Kentucky and preached revivals and Saturday night services and stuff like that. And I don't know, man. I felt like as time went on, I was just regurgitating stuff that I'd been told my whole life, and I was saying the same thing I had been told, and I hadn't experienced the world at all. I was just still this very small town kid that kind of yearned to see what was out there. And that's when I went to college. I kind of left that behind for a little while, and I was having trouble with my faith and what I believed in and everything. So I switched gears. I went to college. I did really well my first year. I majored in creative writing and English literature. Had this great teacher named Rick Thompson that I'm still friends with and talk to from time to time today. But he just made me really love like pseudo subversive literature and poetry. And I got into writing in that style and had a 4.0 my first two semesters, got a scholarship, still borrowed a bunch of money on top of my scholarship so I could party, party too hard. Went back to school after I flunked out my third semester, made it through part of it, and then flunked out again. And then, it's either one extreme or the other, man. I mean, I went from preaching to started living a very worldly life. And then, you know, I got arrested for dealing drugs when I was 20, I think, 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't too bad of an ordeal. And I just was playing some shows around Bowling Green with two of my friends. We had a little band called 88. We were all born in 88, and we rehearsed in my buddy's garage on Highway 88 in Kentucky. So it was an easy name. Yeah. But yeah, I did that, and then I met my wife at a bar in Bowling Green, and I quit playing guitar for 3 years. I didn't sing unless I was in the shower or the car, mm-hmm. you know, and just had to take a little break from it. And I went to Eastern Kentucky and just worked.
Yeah. Is that what led up to you auditioning for American Idol then in 2016? Is that kind of what made you like get back into music?
You got me. I did do that. So what happened, my wife had this group of friends, guy friends that she went to school with all her life. They had a band called Borrow Blue.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, I'm sorry, I don't know how to turn these stupid text messages off on this phone or on this computer.
Oh, they're not coming through on my end, so they should be all good. Good.
So one night, I had been listening to Sturgill Simpson. Somebody introduced me to Sturgill, the Cadillac 3 and Blackberry Smoke. And then I had been listening to the Steel Drivers and the Johnson Brothers, Stapleton's early stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there was this Johnson Brothers song called Barely Alive. And I was like, man, I want to get back into playing guitar. And my old guitar was just so beat up, you couldn't even play it anymore. So I ordered a little Taylor GS Mini, a little 3/4 size guitar off of, what's that music store up in Indiana called? Not Musician's Friend.
Sweetwater. That's like 2 hours where I'm from.
Okay. Yeah. So I ordered from there. My boy Ian Angle, that I still work with up at Sweetwater from time to time, he sends me this guitar. And I learned how to play Barely Alive. And then one night after one of their shows, I went to one of them's house to like kind of party after the show and hang out. And I got a little toasted and just grabbed a guitar and started playing. And I sang Barely Alive. And they were all like, you sing? And I was like, yeah. So they started having me come out and sing their breaks at bars and like open up for them and stuff. And then I started coming with one of those guys down to Nashville not long after that. And, started writing, man. And, you know, it had been 3 years of like just back to my roots, hard ass, hard nosed, blue collar work, shoveling beans, cutting trees, farm work, building pole barns, all this stuff. And my last like blue collar job, I was laying pipe in Alabama, not the fun kind. We were down in Coleman, Alabama, laying sewer lines. And I had this awesome foreman, Steve Rich. He always told me I needed to do something with my music. And one day it was just hot as hell, dude. Like 98 degrees. I'm shoveling gravel in a pipeline ditch. And he's like, I threw my shovel across the site. I was just fed up. And I was like, I'm done with this shit. He's like, where are you going? I said, I'm going to go do something with music. I'm going to go do American Idol or something, you know? And
mm-hmm.
he said, I've been waiting for you to say that. So he talked me down. I finished out my day. I finished out my time there. I went to work for a production company, and in the process of doing that, I was coming down here writing songs, and I met this amazing lady named Precious Harris, and she got me a private audition with American Idol. And I'd already done The Voice once before. Mm-hmm. My mom raised money on GoFundMe without asking me if it was okay. She posted this thing on GoFundMe for me to go to LA and try out for The Voice. Mm-hmm. And I got mad at first. I was like, Mom, don't do that. I don't want to ask people for money. But the next morning, it was already like $3,500. I was like, wow, people want me to go.
Yeah.
So I'll go. I go out there. They're like, no. I get back. Precious calls me. She's like, you should go over and try out for American Idol. And I did. They told me no. And as I was walking out the door, they told me no because I tried to sing an Adele song, and I was having a rough time with my voice that day. I was nervous. Mm-hmm. And it was a little high. I sang it in the wrong key, so I didn't do that well. Well, I was pissed off because I know I could sing the song, you know, but they were like, no. I'm walking out, and this woman says, you know what, come back. I've heard you sing before. I know you can sing well. Like, come back and give us another song. And the guy that told me no, he was like, yeah, maybe try to sing something that you can actually sing. He was a little condescending. He said, so what do you want to sing? And I was like, well, I'm going to sing Barely Alive by the Johnson Brothers. And he goes, oh, okay, you're going to sing Chris Stapleton now. I was like, yeah, by God, I am. So I did, and I guess I just had just enough piss and vinegar. I nailed the notes, and they were like, all right, here you go. Went and did the show and didn't last very long. Thank God. I'm not a huge advocate for those shows or a fan of those shows. I feel like they only really work out for the judges most of the time, putting the little money in their pocket. But, you know, if you want to do that, do it. I did it, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think just doing that kind of made me, I mean, I sang Long As I Can See the Light on the stage at Dolby Theater in Hollywood. And I was like, where do I go from here? I don't want to go back to shoveling beans and, you know, cutting trees and shit. Yeah. So I just started like focusing my energy down here, and it wasn't too long. I think we wrote My Boy within 6 months of being in Nashville. And then all the deals, just everything came really easy the first few years, man. It was a little crazy. That song came along. It got a buzz going around town and got the publishing deal and the record deal. And it feels like all that stuff was the easy part. And now I'm in the hard work, you know?
Right. So yeah, you actually released My Boy independently before you even had your record deal, right?
I never released it. What happened was somebody put a video of us playing it at Whiskey Jam one night up on Facebook, my wife actually. Mm-hmm. And it went viral. And as it was gaining like 100,000 views an hour, we were upwards of however many million views. All of a sudden Facebook took it down. And so I was like, well, damn, that was my 15 minutes, I guess, you know. But little did I know that that had caught the attention of some folks in town in the business. It was very early on in the social media thing. Like I was on the tail end of the old way, you know, and the very beginning of the new way. Social media has always been, or social media is actually, I feel like I was one of the first ones to kind of get a break from social media. Because of that Facebook video, I was able to get my record deal. And then we recorded that song along with many others for the Backslider record. And then it went viral on TikTok, which led to radio really latching on and giving us a shot at country radio. You know, originally I didn't really want to put that song out. Yeah, I mean, the song is, it's my story and everything, but the sound and the vibe of it is very different from anything else that I've done or that I do or I wanted to do. And so I was conflicted, and I remember we were about to pitch it to Luke Bryan, and if we were going to pitch it to somebody, I wanted to go to somebody who would know what it's like, you know. And I know Luke was raising his brother's kids, and I was like, I think he would understand it. So I would love to pitch it to Luke. And as we were talking about it, and I get off the phone, I pull up to my house in Mount Juliet, and I'm walking up to the door, and I remember just grabbing the door handle on the storm door, and God was like, so you mean I'm going to give you this gift that has helped you so much, and you're going to just give it away? And I was like, well, dang, I guess not now. So I just, you know, follow my heart and put it out, and here we are now talking to you.
Yeah. Now, what was it like kind of getting to see that song just rise to the top and, like, the crowd just, like, start screaming it back every night as it got bigger?
Well, that's always an awesome feeling when you see people singing your song back to you, man. I think what I've enjoyed the most out of it, you know, of course, number ones and all that stuff is great. But the coolest part of that song is just hearing everybody's different stories. And I hear somebody's story every show I play. So I tend to stay after my shows and meet everybody that wants to meet and everything. And I just get to hear so many ways that song relates from, you know, boys, girls, dogs, cats, everything, you know. So people have some way that they've associated that song. And even now, I split it up between the boy version and the girl version. Mm-hmm. And when I sing the girl version too, now I think of my daughter, who is, you know, she's 100% my blood, everything, but it still feels the same.
Yeah.
And I think that was the point of the song, is like, it doesn't matter. You know, Garth Brooks had a song on the Scarecrow album back in the day that I loved. It said, blood is thicker than water, but love is thicker than blood. And I always loved that line.
Totally. Now, last month, country music lost a total legend, Toby Keith, and you actually got to tour with him. Is there anything you learned watching him side stage, or any conversations you had with him that stuck out?
Man, I think the thing I loved about Toby the most, I just talked to his background singer at the Opry the other night. She'd been with him for 30 years. You know, his buddy Dave had been with him for 20, 30 years. Everybody in that band had been with him since the beginning. I think that speaks volumes for somebody, and I aspire to be like that. You know, my crew on the road is family. I've got a new band now, but all those old guys that were with me, they're still my friends and family. And they just, a few of them left because they had different aspirations. And I just, the way that he treated his people was awesome. Also, I mean, he was a businessman first and foremost, you know. He was an amazing artist, songwriter, and everything, but he was a businessman. And that was my very first opportunity to go out and open for anybody. Toby Keith was the first one in California. It was me and my buddy Russell Sutton, who I wrote My Boy with. Mm-hmm. We were a duo called Grassroots Revival at the time, and we didn't have any music out, but we were touring the country opening up for, you know, Toby Keith and Lady A and Brothers Osborne, all these different people. It was wild. But yeah, man, Toby just, he was just a man's man, dude. He was a badass. I don't know. Well, I'll keep it PG-16, but my last night on the road with Toby, him and my guys and one of his buddies, they were all drinking till about 4 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And his wife sitting there in the SUV trying to get him to come on and leave. She kept coming out there saying, we got to go, Toby. And he's like, feeling good. Well, finally she walks out, and she's a little lady, you know, Toby, he was a giant. And she walks after, she says, Toby, we have got to go. And he looked at her, and, you know, he'd had a few. He goes, baby, I got a jet, and that son of a bitch don't leave the tarmac till I tell it to. And he was smiling, you know, he was just being a smart ass, but she reached up and grabbed him by the ear and started pulling him to the SUV, and he turned around, was laughing, waving bye to us, and he looked at me and Russell, and he said, y'all are some bad motherfuckers, you know, and I was like, the man said it himself, I must believe it, you know, so, that's and hilarious. I thought he would forget me. I was like, all right, cool, I had my time with Toby, but I seen him at his Country Music Songwriters Hall of Fame induction, and he walked up and slapped me real hard on the ass, and said, you're still a bad mother, you know, and he handed me a challenge coin from it where he got inducted. And I was like, he remembered me, man. I thought that was pretty cool.
That is sick. Now, the new album, Damascus, is dropping April 19th. We were talking before we got on here. I think this is exactly what country music needs right now. The first listen through it, I was getting like major, like early Eric Church vibes, like one of my favorite albums, Chief. It kind of gives that same vibe to me as that. What was your vision going in creating this album?
I think, you know, if I've learned anything from church, it's just that there should be no walls put around what you do.
Yeah.
And he's definitely been a huge influence ever since Sinners Like Me record.
Mm-hmm.
My first record was a collection of what I felt to be my best songs that I'd written over the few years I'd been in town. And I put it together in a way that it kind of explained where I come from, who I am, how I got to Nashville, all that stuff. But it was, I wanted it to be, you know, kind of a live, raw vibe, but it was also a little glazed over on the harder subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had success with My Boy. And my opinion may be biased, but I felt like there were a lot of other songs on that record that should have seen their day, and they didn't. And I think I went through a natural process of being very pissed off about that. And it frustrated me in a lot of ways and kind of screwed my head up for a little while. But I was like, well, hey, if I give it my best shot being who I am and being, you know, honest to who I am, but still trying to be mindful of, like, commerciality and all that, whatever, and it doesn't work out, then on this next project, there's no holds barred. You know, I'm doing me 100%. And it was a struggle, man. Like, you know, I had to have a lot of conversations with folks at the label and stuff. There was a lot of postponing. It got to a point where, you know, I had a conversation with somebody at the label, and I was up in Kentucky, and I said, you know what? I think I'm just going to stay up here. I'm going to go back to work for my father-in-law cutting trees, or I'm going to go drive a truck with my brother or something. And I was like, I've made peace with it. You know, if I have to chase after something, or if I got to start listening to a bunch of songs that everybody else thinks is hits that I should sing, then that's not what I came here to do.
Yeah.
And they called me back and were like, look, we don't want you to do that. Let's get started on this project. I was like, cool, man, give me the rope. I'll either pull myself up or hang myself with it. You know, I want the opportunity to tell the stories I want to tell and be who I am. And finally, after like a year of back and forth, they agreed and we recorded Damascus. And, you know, it's cool because as I'm writing this project and I'm writing songs about prison reform and drug addiction, you know, I start seeing the shift in the industry that was going on, you know, kind of congruently, I guess would be the word, with what I'd been working on. And I think you've seen it the most with folks like Jelly Roll and talking about those things and going and doing the prison shows and the rehabs and stuff, which is something we've also been doing a little bit of. And now, like, it was cool at first, but now it almost feels like this raw, real authenticity thing is becoming a fad in country music. And I think that's a dangerous space to be in when as an industry, you start pushing artists to talk about things that they may not be comfortable with talking about and doing. So I think it needs to be handled at an individual basis. But I'm perfectly comfortable with, you know, sharing my past and the ups and downs. And you'll see that in this record. But some of this record is me, and some of it is inspired. Sorry, I feel like I'm going off on a tangent here, but.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Some of it's me, definitely. But some of it's definitely inspired by other people's stories. I was talking to, I've had the opportunity to meet Steve Earle and write with him a couple times in the last couple years. And I brought up a song one day and I was like, you know, this song is really what pulled me to you when I was a kid. And he was like, well, that ain't me, dog. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. What do you mean? I was like, I fell in love with you because of this. I thought you were this guy. And he said, no, he's like, I would meet people and I would stay with people and I would spend time with people and I would write their stories because I thought their stories were important. And then that made me have even more respect for him. So prime example of this section or part of the record, a song called 215634.
Mm-hmm.
My buddy, I grew up with my oldest childhood friend. We lived across the holler from each other and he'd ride his dirt bike over, or I'd ride a three wheeler over or something. We'd hang out. He, in our 20s, me and him kind of got into the same stuff. And he tended to get in a lot more trouble than I did. So he was out on parole when he's about 30 years old, and this man had threatened to kill him. And, you know, he acquired a gun the way that felons do. And this man, sure enough, kicked in the door one day to kill him and put a gun up to him. And my buddy pulled out his gun and shot and killed this man. But since he was a felon in possession of a firearm, he couldn't claim self-defense. And you'll hear that in the song. The second verse tells that story. But something about that just don't sit right with me. I feel like a man should be able to defend himself, you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, one of my favorites on the record is Fan on High. Kind of just takes me back to like an old saloon. Kind of tell me the story of the process of making that one.
So I was at a writer's retreat that Jody Williams put on here in town. He's a publisher here in town, used to run BMI. But I got in a room with a guy named Hayes Carl and Driver Williams one day. And Driver said, "Hey, man, me and Hayes got this idea we came up with a couple weeks ago, and we feel like you'd be perfect for it." And I said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "Well, it's called Buck Ass Naked with the Fan on High." And I was like, "Well, you got my attention, you know?" So we started writing it, and Hayes sang the demo on it originally, and I love his demo. It just sounds like an old stray alley cat singing it. It's awesome. But when I got in the studio, I was like, there was so much heavy stuff on the record. I was like, I don't want people to think that I take myself entirely too seriously, you know? So how do we fix that? And I brought up Fan on High, and my producer, Oscar Charles, who I thought would be so against it, was like, "Yeah, we should do that." So we brought Gordon Mode in, who's an amazing piano player, Charlie Warsham on guitar. Mm-hmm. And most of this record was cut with my friends and co-writers, but there was a few songs where we brought in, you know, some session players like Gordon, Steve Mackey, Fred Eltringham, Rob McNally, Tom Book. I mean, we had the heavy hitters in there, man. Those are all the guys from the first record. But this particular song, we just brought Charlie, Gordon Moe, and then a co-writer friend of mine, John Sherwood. Oscar played drums, my producer. And I was like, what if we did this like Jerry Lee Lewis kind of vibe with it? So Gordon's like this, you know? And I was like, yeah, exactly like that. And then it talks about Jerry Reed in the second verse. I got Jerry Reed on the Crosley. He's been keeping me good company. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, what if we got Jerry Lee on piano, but we got Jerry Reed. Oh, my God. What if we got Reed on the guitar? And Charlie's like this? And I was like, yeah, exactly like that. So it turned into this, like, barn burner.
Yeah.
And that's such a fun song to do out live. It's the only song I've ever had that people are literally singing the first time they hear it. They're singing it, you know, by the end of the first chorus. So that was totally a fun one to add to the project for sure.
Now, I like to close my interviews by asking, what's a piece of advice you'd give to the aspiring artists and songwriters out there that you've learned along your journey?
Man, you just got to do it for the reasons that you came here to do it, you know, whether it's Nashville or Eastern Kentucky, like my buddy Hunter Flynn right now, who's out there doing his thing. I think you got to just be who you are. There's always going to – here's the thing. Everybody that you – the team that you build around you, everybody wants the same thing. They want to see you be successful. But everybody's got their own ideas of what that success looks like. So you got to decide for yourself what success is. For me, success, although I would love to make a little money too, my main goal in success is just to do something I'm proud of, talk about things that I want to talk about in my music, and, you know, not feel for a moment that I'm faking anything when I'm on stage. Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing that anybody can take with them is just be you and be raw, be real, all the buzzwords that are going on these days, you know, is it frustrates me a little bit, but none of us are all that special. So if you just be who you are and tell your stories, then you'll believe it when you sing it and you'll feel it when you sing it. And I feel like that's how you get other people to believe and feel what you're doing.
Thank you so much for listening in this week, and thank you again to LV for coming on the show. I had a great time talking with you, man. Everyone follow him on Instagram at LVShaneMusic, and check out his brand new album, Damascus, out on April 19th. Check out Starting Small Music on YouTube to see all the video content from our interviews. And also, follow Starting Small Music on Instagram at Starting Small Music, and let us know who you'd like to hear on the podcast next.